The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. And we're reading from the March 2021 edition of Smithsonian. The article I've picked out to read first is Healers of Navajo Nation. Combining traditional medicine and modern science, these courageous physicians rise to the challenge of the pandemic. And this is written by Jade Begay, B-E-G-A-Y. A year ago, when spring rains made their way through the Southwest and the frozen earth began to warm, the first cases of COVID-19 appeared in Navajo Nation. Though sparsely populated with 172,000 residents in a region the size of West Virginia, Navajo Nation was particularly susceptible to the pandemic because of systematic poverty, chronic food insecurity, and overall poor health. The tribe faced such high infection and death rates, at least 975 people have died of COVID-19, that the federal government set aside $714 million in aid to the Dene people, D-I-N-E, with a little mark over it, the Dene people, as we are called in our native language. But perhaps the most noteworthy response to the onslaught of disease has been the work of courageous caregivers, including the five physicians pictured here, and there's a picture of a physician, obviously Native American, all quick to rise to the historic challenge. In the blink of an eye, community tents went up, red triage tents went up, and we had to cancel all our elective surgeries, says Vanessa Jensen, a surgeon in Fort Defiance, Arizona. Michelle Tom, a physician working in Winslow, Arizona, began doing car triage for Dene patients, a drive-through arrangement for testing patients quickly and safely. Navajo Nation has always lacked adequate infrastructure to meet residents' needs, even compared with other rural areas. This deficiency stems from the Federal Army's push in the mid-1800s to conquer Navajo lands and forcibly relocate the Dene to reservations. In a territory spanning 27,000 square miles across Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, there are only 13 grocery stores. Around 15,000 homes lack access to electricity. About one in three families must haul water to their homes every day. Scant health care facilities, 400 or fewer hospital beds, and shortages of medical equipment, including ventilators, have also made it tough to cope with COVID-19. On the Navajo Reservation, we have unique social issues that are extremely challenging that the rest of the world may not completely understand, said Jennifer Whitehair, an obstetrician gynecologist working with Native patients in Tuba City, Arizona. I think they would find it difficult to believe that these living conditions could exist in a non-third world country. Tom, who specializes in family medicine, collaborated with locals to distribute supplies such as personal protective equipment, water, and other basic necessities to community members. Appearing on NBC News in April, she detailed the dire needs of her patients and colleagues. People responded by sending hundreds of thousands of dollars, masks, gloves, face shields, water, and non-perishable foods. Tom worked with an existing nonprofit, United Natives, to handle the donations and found warehouse space to store the supplies. The group sent about $120,000 just on disinfectant sprays and wipes. A lot of elders sent me their stimulus checks, Tom says, but I couldn't bring myself to take their donations. I ended up sending those back because I felt like they needed it. Whitehair recalls her first COVID patient. The patient was COVID positive at 37 weeks, pregnant, febrile with severe shortness of breath. I was still really scared because all I had seen was death at this point, and interacting with a COVID-positive patient felt like a potential death sentence for all of us healthcare workers. She goes on, I was very afraid of bringing this home to my family, especially my father, who is Navajo and has other health comorbidities. Still, White Hair persevered. I put on all my personal protective gear and went to the hospital to see her. She was too sick to stay at our rural hospital, but ended up getting transported to a higher level of care. She delivered a healthy baby and did extremely well after getting better. With about half of adults on Navajo Nation afflicted by type 2 diabetes or prediabetes, physicians worry what COVID concerns are leading some to, such as overlooking other medical risks. A lot of patients got so scared and forgot to take care of themselves and forgot to take care of their diabetes, says Sophina Cauldron, a doctor at Tuba City Regional Health Care Corporation in Arizona. Like most indigenous cultures, Diné people are deeply rooted in their community, family, clanship, or as we say, kia, kinship, is a fundamental value, helping us understand who we are. The pandemic has threatened that part of life. Navajo families are large, says LaWanda Jim, a physician who practices in Shiprock, New Mexico. I have 60 first cousins and numerous aunts and uncles, and we miss one another during the pandemic. It wasn't unheard of to gather year-round to celebrate weddings, graduations, and ceremonies. My family is involved in summer and in winter ceremonies. My son dances in the winter ceremonies. When we're not able to gather the way we do, it weighs heavily on us because that was a resource for maintaining our resilience. As a result, Jim says, I've had to think about, how do we do this? How do we acknowledge our relationships and keep those relationships strong despite social distancing, wearing masks, not being able to shake hands? Say, ya, 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 hello, in parentheses. At the core of Diné culture is Hozo, a philosophy of harmony, beauty, and mental and spiritual wellness. More broadly, Hozo refers to a way of walking this earth that is inherently good. Diné physicians have integrated Hozo into medical care. Some clinics offer spaces where people can pray with traditional medicines, while others have hired traditional practitioners to support patients. Being Diné and working a lot of patients who rely heavily on traditional medicine, I went about trying to work with medicine men to formulate a safe plan, says Cauldron. With her colleagues, she developed new ways to hold traditional healing and prayers, like phone calls or Zoom meetings. In November, like many communities around the country, Navajo Nation saw a new surge in cases, with the positivity rate soaring 37.8% on November 20. But in December, vaccines brought new hope, and Tom says she and her staff are better prepared with every passing day. Before, there was a lot of fear. Now I know what to say to patients. I know what I'm looking for, and I can give my patients better answers so they feel more comfortable. Things are a lot better. The mental health of my colleagues is better, and the work is more manageable, mentally, physically, even spiritually. There's a picture of Dr. Jennifer Whitehair, MD, OBGYN for 18 years, Tuba City Regional Healthcare Corporation, Arizona. Jennifer Whitehair wears a traditional Navajo rug, dress, and sash woven by her paternal aunt. Another aunt gave her these slippers when she graduated from medical school in 2002. She's in her scrubs in this photo. Whitehair is wearing a face mask that represents the missing and murdered indigenous women's movement. Whitehair hand-beaded the stethoscope herself. The Navajo are resilient, she says, and their strength in times of turmoil will pull them closer together after this is all over. The next article is under the heading Institutional Knowledge. Lonnie G. Bunch III, Secretary. I assume that's Secretary of the Smithsonian. It doesn't say that, though. Bending toward justice, we must use the lessons of the past to help our country grow and move forward. This country has witnessed many moments of bitter disagreement. The earliest elections of our fledgling nation, when the democratic structures of freedom and self-government were still open questions. The election of 1864, during the Civil War, a referendum on the principles of liberty, equality, and basic dignity. The 2000 election of President Bush, hinging on 537 votes and a Supreme Court decision. In each of these elections, no matter how contentious, both sides accepted the result. This is how a democracy moves forward. On January 6, after a long morning of work, I took a break and turned my head to the television. I could not believe what I saw. An armed mob flying the Confederate flag had taken the Capitol, defaced the building, and attacked Capitol Police. I knew the history. I knew that no group had breached the Capitol since the British did in 1814. This was an unprecedented threat to our democratic system. The appalling violence that claimed the lives of five people was an assault on our highest institutions and our most sacred values, the constitutional right of the American people to self-determination. As a historian, I have always felt that my responsibility is to give hope, to use the lessons of the past to help our country grow and move forward. In that moment, I had difficulty believing the idea that the arc of history bends towards justice. How could we move forward from such violence and turmoil? As I have grappled with this question over the last 2 months, I have found optimism in the continued resilience of the American people. In moments of reconciliation and the shared recognition of the urgency of this moment. In the work of colleagues across the Smithsonian who help our country remember our shared values, shared heritage, shared hopes. On January 20, First Lady Jill Biden, whose Landscape with Rainbow by Robert Duncanson from the collections of the Smithsonian American Art Museum at the 59th inaugural painting. Perhaps the most well-known African-American painter of the mid-19th century, Duncanson painted this landscape on the eve of Civil War, expressing a hope for peace, a vision of an American that could be. Once again, our country has reached an inflection point. Will we embrace the principles of justice, equality, and liberty? History teaches us democracy is only as strong as our continued resolve to fight for it. We cannot wait for the moral arc of the universe to bend toward justice. We must work to bend it ourselves. This is American Icon. After the storming of Congress in early January, some rioters were apparently surprised to learn that the mere traffic circle where they were being arrested was, in fact, the Peace Monument, and part of the U.S. Capitol grounds. Mostly unnoticed on ordinary days, the ghostly eroded statue at the end of Pennsylvania Avenue became a focal point in the news footage of the violent afternoon and remains an enigmatic emblem of its aftermath. The Peace Monument, strangely enough, got its rocky start as a war memorial in honor of lost Union sailors and Marines. It was conceived by Admiral David Dixon Porter, a famous commander who intended it for the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, where he served as superintendent. He personally raised funds and, in 1871, commissioned the sculpture, even sketching out his own vision and taking fire for it. Porter knows more about the high seas than he does about high art, one critic sniped. An amalgam of classical allusions and Victorian funerary motifs, the sculpture remains something of a puzzle to modern eyes. It's a mishmash monument, says Elise Friedland, a George Washington University scholar who is researching a book about the capital city's classical art and architecture. At the top, which reaches around 44 feet, is the bookish muse of history, consulting a tome inscribed, "They died that their country might live." Another female figure, believed to be Grief, cries on history's shoulder. Below gloats Victory. At her feet are cherubic versions of Mars and Neptune, toying with sword and trident. And where is this figure of peace? Tacked onto the back of the sculpture, like an afterthought. Swept away by passion for this memorial project, Porter waited until his final fundraising efforts had all but capsized to share his plans with Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles. The two men had a contentious relationship. Welles served his country in its darkest hour with fidelity and zeal, if not with conspicuous ability. Porter once wrote, and Welles vetoed Porter's plan, "The Naval Memorial, as it was called, would not sail to Annapolis after all, nor be installed at the Academy. But Congress scrounged up funds and found a second best spot at the foot of Capitol Hill, sculpted by the prolific Maine native Franklin Simmons at his studio in Rome. The star-crossed monument was shipped to the District of Columbia in pieces and finished in 1877. The Statue of Peace was, in fact, a last-minute addition and faces the Capitol in an inexplicably topless state. Why is peace naked? Friedland wonders. Peace was perhaps a political compromise added to mollify former Confederates in Congress who weren't eager to support a tribute to the Union cause. Porter shot off a note to the architect of the Capitol. If this statue doesn't make members of Congress feel peaceful, I don't know what will. A novelty in the city full of war memorials, this makeshift peace shrine was not formally dedicated or even quite finished. The design called for bronze dolphins that still haven't surfaced. Made of Carrara marble, a material as vulnerable to the elements as peace itself, the monument has not handled acid rain and pollution well. The human faces have blurred. A marble dove at peace's feet flew the coop long ago. Body parts have snapped off and been replaced. Making sense of the elaborate artwork has never been straightforward. This is the issue with these allegorical monuments, says University of Pittsburgh art historian Kirk Savage. They can kind of mean anything. It's inevitable, he says, that the monument would be appropriated for other reasons and uses. Besides, he adds, it seems pretty easy to climb. In 1971, Vietnam War protesters scaled the monument and rested with flags at the top, looking like statues themselves. During the insurrection this past January, somebody slung a scarf around Victory's neck, and a guy wearing a cowboy hat and holding a bullhorn loomed over Baby Mars, god of war. Contemporary peace memorials tend toward radical simplicity. An installation outside Oslo City Hall, where the Nobel Peace Prize is handed out, is a smile-shaped arc, but some artists see immense power in antique statuary. Christoph Woldzickio, who worked with video projections and has beamed the faces of traumatized soldiers onto the Lincoln Memorial in New York City's Union Square Park, says the peace monument's human forms have a hold on us. We have a special relationship to those statues. We identify with them. We animate them without knowing who they are. We want them to witness what we want to say. Sometimes we sit on their shoulders and put flags in their hands. In the days after the Capitol riot, a new face appeared at the peace monument. Brian Sicknick, the Capitol Police officer who died of injuries sustained in the mob attack. Mourners also left photographs of him beside cut flowers and American flags. A cardboard sign said, "Rest in peace." Here's a sidebar. titled Attack on the Capitol. British troops torched the building during a chaotic 26 hours in the War of 1812, but the symbol of democracy stood, by Ted Scheinman. On the March, 26 months after the United States declared war on Britain, 4,500 British troops under Major General Robert Ross served a humiliating defeat to U.S. forces at Bladensburg, Maryland. Ross orders the Redcoats to march the 6 or more miles to Washington, D.C. And there's a picture of him in his redcoat and fancy hat. The city empties. President James Madison, who rode with the American troops at Bladensburg, leaves the field for the capital city, but will promptly flee, as will his cabinet. About 90% of the population is gone by the time the enemy arrives. And I see I'm reading these out of order. I should have read this one called Victory. Toward the evening, American troops fire on British forces approaching the capital from the northeast, killing several soldiers and Ross's horse. Still, the invaders prevail before nightfall and are able to raise the Union Jack over the Capitol Hill. Taking the Senate, in the north wing, soldiers burn the Library of Congress, 3,000 volumes at the time, torch the Senate chamber and topple marble columns. The heat nearly crumples exterior walls, some of which will be incorporated into a restored and expanded Capitol in coming decades. The People's House. Inside the original Capitol, which was opened to Congress in 1800, British soldiers lay waste to the east side of the South Wing, home to the House of Representatives. The building is largely brick and sandstone, but they slather gunpowder paste on wooden supports and structures and ignite bonfires. The heat is so intense, the roof falls in. And, yes, I must admit I read these out of order. Here's the last one. The siege ends. The dawn of August 25, 1814. British Rear Admiral George Cockburn, who had wanted to burn far more of the city before Ross declared private property off limits, infamously stands atop the chair of the House Speaker while whipping up his troops. But the occupation doesn't last. A powerful rainstorm the next day prompts British troops to withdraw from the capital. 4 months later, British and American delegates will sign the Treaty of Ghent, putting an official end to the war. With my apologies, but the human mind does have the ability to put things into order. Out of the Shadows by Amy Crawford. A new exhibition brings an overlooked Mississippi painter into the light. Beautiful painting here. Can't quite tell what it is. It's rather abstract, but I think it's supposed to be. Well, I'll read what she says it is. While her paintings eventually became entirely abstract, Bungie's earlier work included lively port scenes and Cubanist-inspired still lifes. And this is called Sunflowers and Squash, 1944. Labeled an artist of the Deep South by critics who praised her vigorous and dramatic abstract expressionist canvases, Dusty Bungay, née Eunice Lye Swetman, 1903 to 1993, spent most of her life in her native Biloxi, Mississippi, painting in a backyard studio. Her gallerist, the visionary Betty Parsons, who also represented Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, urged Bungay, whose friends nicknamed her Dusty because she was often washing dust off her face, to relocate to New York, then the center of the art world. She decided that really wasn't her, says J. Richard Gruber, author of a new illustrated biography of the artist that accompanies a major retrospective on view at the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson through May. Dusty's choice may be part of why she remains little known outside the South. But Gruber believes it's time for that to change. She's one of many important women who have remained in the shadows of male artists for too long. It's also her connection to Biloxi, with its tropical light, streets paved with oyster shells, and intermix of black, white, and immigrant communities that makes her art unique, he argues. That's a strong tradition in the South, that connection to place. She traveled the world, but Biloxi was really her world. And that was titled Out of the Shadows, a new exhibition brings an overlooked Mississippi painter into the light, by Amy Crawford. And here are some of the letters giving some feedback to Smithsonian. Ancestral Lands. As a former Yellowstone seasonal employee, I often imagine Native peoples hunting or telling stories as nearby geysers whooshed and hot springs boiled, referring to the lost history of Yellowstone. In your article, when Shane Doyle proposed a living history encampment of tribal college students in Yellowstone to educate visitors about these original inhabitants, I recall George Catlin, America's artistic chronicler of vanishing Native nations in the 1830s. Catlin suggested decades before Yellowstone's establishment that the government set aside a nation's park with Native Americans displaying their skills and lifestyle. Catlin's proposal and Al Doyle's would be quite an amazing addition to Yellowstone, provided it ensured education, not exploitation. And that was submitted by Jim Thompson in Bozeman, Montana. We'll read one more. Reckoning with Reconstruction. Thank you for your comprehensive and enlightening article about Joseph Hayne Rainey, first in the House. How could it be that as a 68-year-old, growing up middle class, public schooled, and college educated, I was never exposed to this courageous man and his fellow Reconstructionist activists until I read your article? We must integrate these stories into our history curriculum as early as possible. Thus says David Corbin of Poway, California. Making the Nation has a caption, and the U.S. early apprenticeships perpetuated skills until child labor laws intervened. That could leave the mistaken impression that apprenticeship is dependent upon child labor. As a retired union laborer, I am most proud of our labor management apprenticeship programs. Some $1.5 billion is invested annually by the unionized construction industry. That's our cue that our time is up. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Call us if you have any questions at 919-832-5138.